to get us going here. This is Roger Eardley Pryor conducting an oral history with Katrina Baxter. We are at the United Way building in Philadelphia on Benjamin Franklin Parkway. It is July 27th, 2017. Katrina, could you spell your name for us?
Yes, it's K-I-R-T-R-I-N-A, Baxter, B-A-X-T-E-R.
Great. When were you born?
1969.
1969, that's a good year.
Good year, all right.
Where were you born?
I was born in New Brunswick, New Jersey.
Okay.
Yeah, I didn't think my family lived there long, so we were there for about maybe a year and a half. No, longer than that, because my sister underneath me is about, she and I are about 14 months apart, and she was born there too, and then we moved after her, so maybe when I was three, we moved to Willingboro, New Jersey.
Okay.
And I don't remember New Brunswick at all.
What do you remember about Willingboro?
Well, I was in Willingboro all my childhood, so I lived and grew up there. And so I remember a lot about Willingboro.
tell me a little bit about your family. You mentioned you have a sister. What's her name?
Yeah, I have three sisters. Yes. And there are Tracy, Trisha, and Tremaine. Mm-hmm. We're all TRs. So
yeah.
By extension, some of us. And we grew up, it was three of us growing up, though. My little younger sister wasn't born until we were in high school, so she didn't really grow up with us, per se. So we were three girls growing up in Willingboro, New Jersey, which at the time, in the 70s, was majority white. It was right after redlining, you know, had sort of been squashed, so we were able to move into, you know, this suburb area, into this, you know, like, you know, in a nice neighborhood, so supposedly. So it was, you know, it was a really, actually, I call it a charmed experience growing up, because my block was very unique in that, you know, the neighbors across the street were Seventh Day Adventists, and they were people of color. Our neighbors next door were Jewish. Our neighbors on the other side were Catholic. You know, we had Italian family on a block, a family from Haiti, and some Puerto Ricans, right? A male nurse. Like, we had a lot of diversity, just like on our block.
Yeah.
And as you know, as a child, everything is about your block, right? So, like, my whole life was the block. And the black church. So my dad's a pastor. My parents now co-pastor. At the time, he was just a pastor. And so, you know, we had always had a black community of support all my life because of the black church. So when I think back on, you know, my childhood, you know, I've always had this support of black folks around me, right? Even though we lived in this majority white community. And on my block, you know, it was very diverse. So I even thought about or experienced a whole lot of, well, I didn't experience a whole lot of racism growing up that I took and understood as racism. I don't think I had my first experience. I knew about it because we talked about it. You know, it was very much a part of what our conversations were at home. You know what I mean? The experience of black folks in this society. My dad was a black radical preacher, very much so akin to the conversation or the sermons that you would hear that they talked about a lot with Obama's first preacher, and they were like, that he had to distance himself from because of, like, all the stuff that he would talk about in his pulpit, which for me was a very regular thing in the black pulpit, right? You know, the conversations that he was having that people took offense to, or conversations that we constantly have in our community because it's important.
They need to
and
be
it
told.
Needs to be, yeah. And they need to be told, right? And had. So that, you know, so my childhood was, you know, sort of one that included resistance, that included an understanding and a political, you know, political understanding of our place in society, and also being girls, all of us girls, you know, my dad and my parents were very much about, you can do whatever you want, you know what I'm saying? So, like, we didn't have a huge patriarchal, you know, sort of like, you know, this is what girls do type thing. You know, my sisters were ball players, you know, I mean, my dad was a coach, you know, and he didn't have any boys, so he didn't have no choice but to inspire us to, you know, to do whatever we wanted to do. And, you know, I don't know, in the church you do, you know, the patriarchy in the church is real, right? And a lot of religious institutions. And I think that when I think back, though, on my parents' relationship, and also see it now, and it's and what it is, that although, you know, the onus of having, you know, the male be the, you know, the leader or the head of the household, my parents were always in a shared space of decision making, and my mother's voice and word was always heard and always valued, right?
Can you tell me a little bit more about your parents? They sound,
yeah,
they sound wonderful.
They're pretty awesome.
What are their names?
So Lily and Kirk Baxter. They're still married, 50-something years now, so they're pretty, and, like, best friends, which is really an amazing feat.
Yes. And so my parents are as well. Uh-huh. And it's, in some ways, it's intimidating.
Yeah.
Right? You're like, they did it. They found it. Like, they made it work.
True. I think it's a generational thing, though. I totally look at it like, you know what? Everyone's not going to have that. A lot of folks from their generation have that, and we're able to hold on to that. Mm. You know, and I'm thankful for that, that they were like this example of, you know, what could be. You know, my mom used to say to me, why do you have such a bad view of marriage? It's like, because it doesn't come from us. It's like, you're right. It comes from everyone else around us,
right.
You know?
Yeah.
We are in this like isolated island of, you know, protected families, you know, in a way. Mm. And loving and encouraging families. So my dad very much was the disciplinary, I don't even say that, because my mom is a very strong
How
woman.
Did they meet?
They met, I don't know, the church.
Oh yeah,
they met in church. So my dad is a second generation, maybe third generation pastor. So he's been preaching in their family forever. Mm-hmm. My mother grew up in Philadelphia, so she's from here. All her family's from here, and for most of the part, you know, they came up, migrated from Virginia, and they have a very strong. She has 12 siblings, and so the
that's
women
a big family.
And yeah, that's a big family. My father only has 4, but they have 12 in their family now. And all the women in my mom's family are really strong women and presences in my life, like throughout. And so they met in high school when she, like in the 12th grade, I think, when at a conference here in Philadelphia, at the church conference or something. And he lived in Coatesville, which is like a little country place outside of town, and you know, and to him, to her, he was like totally country, because she's from the, you know, this big girl from the city, from this huge family that's, you know, my uncles were badasses, so, and he said he used to, when he'd come to visit her, he would like, you know, tell people, I'm going to see Jazz's sister, and they would leave him alone, because my uncles were in gangs, you know, so they're pretty interesting, and that they came from two different walks of life. My grandmother was a single parent. Her husband passed away.
Which grandmother?
My mother's mother. Yeah, her husband passed away when my mother was young, so she raised the children on her own.
Wow.
Right. Well, and not completely, because of course, you know, she has an extended family who had helped at times. Some of my uncles were raised up down south. Mm-hmm. She raised most of the girls. And of most of the guys, actually just 2 of them grew up down south. So, but, you know, they had help. So, you know, everything within our families for a long time was very integrated. So, you know, the raising of children is something that everyone participated in.
Takes a village, right?
Yeah, definitely. So my grandmother lived to be 94. So she was pretty present in my life for a long time. My dad's mother is still living, and she's 103. And she's still in Coatesville, Pennsylvania.
Wow.
Yeah.
So when you're growing up in Williamsburg?
Willingboro.
Mm-hmm. And you're coming to visit Philadelphia and seeing all this family.
Yeah.
What were your memories of those experiences being in Philly as a little girl?
Yeah, oh man, we had lots of fun. It was like, you know, this is where you come to do all the things you couldn't really do in the suburbs. Like, but we played the same games, really, you know. It was just a lot more dangerous, right? More cars going by. You know, jumping rope crossing the street was a big deal, of being able to stay out because you're visiting your cousins. So that doesn't really matter where we were. You know, when you get all the cousins together, you know, you just get into things that you wouldn't normally get into. So we had, you know, summers were spent and, you know, with our cousins here in the city. I think about that now, about how, you know, people used to, like my mom, when she was growing up, they would spend summers in the South, right? And then after years, you know, progressing, we had been so removed from the South. Folks spent their city, you know, folks who moved out to the suburbs spent the summers in the cities, which is a very interesting contrast that I've been sort of pondering lately.
What do you think about it?
Yeah, I'm thinking about wanting to know other people's experience about that, and to see, like, you know, what we lost, right, from not going down to the country, but going to the city. The difference between, like, going, you know, they were sent down to the country before, when, you know, people were like, if a child wasn't manageable, or if they were, you know, it was the punishment was, you know, you send you down south. But when you go down south, you had this really visceral experience with the environment, right, and nature, and maybe fishing, depending on where your family lives, and definitely farming, you know, where your family lives. And so, you know, it's like picking food and, you know, having those experiences grounded a lot of people in the generation before me. And then those of us who didn't have that experience by going to the South, we were going to the city, the very different grounding, right? A very different experience of kinship, But one not really attached to the land. And because, you know, my work is around land mm-hmm. and the environment, I think always about when were the times that we were able to, you know, reach out and touch the land in certain ways. Like when we were kids in Philadelphia, my cousins and I would catch bees. Everything was catching lumber, like those carpenter bees, like the big fat ones, which is like, it's so mean. I don't know why we did that. Put them in jars, you know, kept them on our cabinet, along with lightning bugs. Of course, everyone caught lightning bugs. Mm-hmm. But every now and then I talk about how we used to take off the bug, the little glowy part, and put them on as like ring of fingers. And people would be like, ew, I can't believe you did that. And I was just like, I thought everyone did that.
Yeah, they did that.
But people are like, that was so mean. I was like, you're right, it was mean. We were cruel kids. So we did things like that in the city, you know. We didn't go to public pools much. Like that was something that we had a lot of pools in the suburbs. So one of the awesome, spent all summer long at the pool. And so in the city, it was like one of those things you couldn't do. So we didn't like to come for long periods of time because that meant that we couldn't swim, you know, because you don't go to public schools and public pools in Philly, apparently. Mm-hmm. Now they do. I don't know what it was for back in the day, but my parents, my family were like, yeah, no going to the public pool. So most of my cousins in the city couldn't swim. So they didn't know how to swim.
Yeah.
So we do different things. But we go to the beach every summer with my family. We go to the south, go
Where
down
the south?
to Virginia. Mm-hmm. We have family reunions every year, and when we were children growing up. And you know, it's interesting how we lose, you know, we don't do that anymore. They still have them apparently, but we don't do them anymore.
Where in Virginia do you remember being?
We're in Goochland, so my family is from Goochland, Virginia, which is about 45 minutes outside of Richmond.
Okay.
East of Richmond. And and then we would always stop through Virginia Beach on the way home, right? So then mm-hmm. we'd go to the beach for a day or two on the way home, me and my cousins and my aunts and uncles, and it was fun. Mm-hmm. So that was our summers, you know, we didn't get into too much trouble, just kid stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When you were a little girl and you have these three sisters that are similar in age and, mm-hmm. and playing together and these cousins in the city, mm-hmm. what were the kind of things you imagined that you dreamed about? What were
right.
your like childhood visions?
Yeah, well, you know, I think if you talk to my sisters, they would tell you that I was always a dreamer. Mm-hmm. I think as a middle child, right, and my head is always in books and always in the stars, right, of what could be. And so I had I was always very much into the multicultural experience, I think, when I was a kid. So I had like a really menagerie of friends that I would bring to the house, and my friends and my family would be like, who and how did you meet these people always all my life? So I remember that as a very young child, bringing people home and, you know, people who were, you know, who, because I was pretty pop, I've always been likable, right? Not popular always, but likable. And so I found that I always had a tendency to want to befriend the underdog. So those people in my classes, you know, in our class that other people didn't want to play with or something like that would be my friends, right? And mm-hmm. And because, you know, I was likable, you know, that allowed them a certain amount of security, right? It's weird kid stuff that they do, mean things to each other. And I was always the one sort of like, no, don't mess with her, she's my friend. And it's so funny. Or bringing home, one time I brought home this young man from school who said that his family was hitting him and beating him. And my dad was like, what do you want me to do? I was like, he can't go back home, Dad. You know, like, he got to do something. Because he couldn't. I don't even remember how that ended up. But I think that I've always had a sense of fairness, right? And so in my childhood, I didn't, you know, it just made sense to me that everyone should be able to treat everyone a certain way. And I think that had a lot to do also with my upbringing, right, in the Christian church. Because before, you know, before you become a pubescent and before you become an adolescent, you know, they teach you about Jesus' love, right, during your childhood. All you learn about is, you know, how Christ was so loving and all these things that he did for these, you know, for different people who were pariah of society, who were, you know. And so that's what I grew up with, those stories I grew up on. And, you know, and I really embodied that and understood that, you know, that we should be treating each other a certain way and that certain things were unfair, right? Mm-hmm. And so, because that's the only place I could remember getting that from, right, and also my parents, right, because also my parents, as pastors and just really kind people, were always, like, taking people in. You know, we had families who lived with us at certain times. A lot of my cousins stayed with us through periods of time when, you know, when there were struggles in their families. Different military men used to stay at the house, you know, And I think about that all the time, how many young men grew up with us. I have a lot of play brothers. They're all, you know, way older than we are, but they were, you know, there for us as young girls in the house and super respectful of my father. So there was never at a time where we had any issue around, you know, around sexuality. And that, which is, when I think back, was a really interesting thing. But not interesting because my dad commands that kind of respect because that's how respectful he is to others, right? Mm. So, and he would never put us in harm's way in that sense. And so we were blessed to have like this really safe community growing up, you know, that I feel like a lot of people that I've realized now it's a blessing that a lot of people didn't have. And what came along with that also was the ability for us as young people to have friendships across gender lines, right? That, you know, as I got older, the more I would hear, you know, young people say like, oh, I don't have any boys and girls can't be friends, you know, guys and girls can't be friends. And I'm just like, that's the most absurd thing I've ever heard, because I've had friends all my life that are not in the same of the same gender as mine, and my cousins and I, play cousins of course, at some point we're talking about that a few years ago, and they're like, that's because we had really safe spaces that adults made sure it was safe for us to be able to interact in a way that was comfortable, right? So that, you know, so that we were, you know, we were always in these situations within the church, within our church family, where boys and girls were together and adults were around us but letting us do our thing, you know. So they, you know, so we were able to be friends to each other. So friendship between the genders is not something that's challenging to me, right? It's something that comes easily. I think it's something that's natural, and that when it's cultivated in your community, that it's something that, you know, that is really beneficial for all of us. The concept around, you know, not having, not women and men not being able to be friends is just bizarre. So it's ridiculous.
What were some of your memories of schooling? I mean, you have, like, you have this amazing social sphere, this network of support and love and opportunity, and just, I mean, a really neat space to grow up as a child. What would then is school life like?
Yeah, I know, right? What was school life? School sucked. I was really smart, but not really into school, right? I'm a middle kid, so I say I did anything that I did what I had to do just so I could pass. I never really was aspiring to do any, you know, I wasn't competitive at all, you know. I just wanted to read books, right?
What kind of books did you like reading?
Little kid books, so like Judy Blume back in the day. I'm dating myself, but I did tell you already how old I was. So Judy Blume and things like that, Green Worms, How to Eat Fried Green Worms, and, you know, just fun stuff, you know, fun kid stuff. And sci-fi, like a little bit of fantasy, right? I've always read fantasy books, and that stopped, of course, when I started liking boys. So all the reading stopped in junior high school until college. And so school was something that was just there. I think that for me, because when I think back, I can't even remember teachers' names. Mm-hmm. Like, it was so, like not really a huge part of my life. What I do remember most is that one of my best friend's father was a teacher, and they were black, and there was a black family, so it was a big deal that I had we had a black teacher in the second grade and also in the fourth grade, and you know, at the time in the suburbs as it was, that, and they were both really present in the school for those of us who were black students. And so I never felt like a lot of tension in my school with regards to race, because we had these really strong black figures in the elementary school that I went to. It's junior high school was a more of a mix, because then in the suburb where I live at, we have little community groups. So there's a section, right? We have sections of town. So Willenboro, people live in Buckingham, Twin Hills, Pennypacker, that kind of thing. And each section had their own elementary school. Mm-hmm. So that folks from those elementary schools went to the same sort of intermixed and went to
junior
high. Right. Mm-hmm. So then at junior high, like, everything changes, right? So then it's like, you know, your world opens up. It's no longer just your block. It's, you know, all these other people. And then things definitely got crazy. friendships, I think, you know, with wanting to, you know, the people that I hang out with are different, you know, wanting to find new social groups, you know, and then feeling bad about leaving these other social groups, you know, that, and then junior high school, you know, the period of growth that young people are going through at a time is about identity, right? So just trying to find myself in this large group of, you know, people that are new in my life wasn't interesting. And then also being able to make friendships with people that I had just peripherally known through, like, maybe social activities around town, right? And then, oh, now I can be friends with, so that my very best friend now, I met in the fourth grade through my elementary school friend, and then we became solid best friends in sixth grade, right? Mm-hmm. In junior high, when we were able to spend more time together because we're in school together.
Yeah.
You know, outside of school, you know, you're still just hanging on your block, and folks who are in your church, right? You don't get to go out. So it was a time when we were able to, like, start riding our bikes and go to other parts of the city, you know, the town, not a city, to the city and experience other people, what was happening in their lives around there. And
what did that experience do for you?
Yeah, I think that opened up the possibilities of, like, sort of what I feel like I could attain, right? You know, like, even just the riding of the bike, right? Like, being able to ride your bike off of the block was, like, a big deal. You know, your whole world opened up. My whole world opened up, the possibilities of where I could go, right? What I could do for my 3 hours after school before I had to be back home was a whole lot more adventurous than it was, you know, when I had to just be on the block for those 3 hours. Mm-hmm. So I think it gave us a sense of adventure. My sisters and I, we rode our bikes. My younger sister and I were closer. And so we did everything sort of together. Our family just made us do everything together anyhow. So, you know, everything we did, we couldn't do alone. We had to do en masse. So if it wasn't me and my sisters and my cousins, and we just had to do everything. And that stayed with us until we graduated high school. So everything was done in group situations. So I've been working in collectives, I feel like, my entire life, because we had to do things in groups. Fortunately, my daughter, who's she's an only child, I used to be like, well, you can't go until you find some friends. She's like, Mama won't go nowhere because you keep trying to hold me to the same standard that your parents did. And I don't have people like that in my life. And I'm like, you should though. Okay, go. So I really had to understand that, okay, that was my experience and that's not for everyone, but it kept us safe, right?
When you were going on these adventures and your world is expanding, but you're doing this in mass with your community and the people you care and are with, what was your role? What kind of role do you think you played in those groups?
Right. So I think about that a lot because I do a lot of soul searching. So I imagine I'm a fire sign. I'm a Sagittarius. I'm a fire sign, so I have a lot of fire in my sign. Mm-hmm. And I'm also a middle child, right? So I have this, you know, this sort of, I was never pushed to be a leader, but I found that because I have a lot of passion. I've been put in situations of negotiation. So I think when I was a kid, I thought I was like the negotiator, right? I was the ultimate communicator. Like, okay, we can talk about this. You know, that was my role all the time. I was the mediator between parties. That was my role forever. So yeah. That was my role.
Yeah.
Definitely.
When you made the transition from junior high into high school, was it still the same community?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. So from when you first left that community, that was after high school.
Yeah.
Tell me what high school was like. What are some of your memories from that?
Yeah, high school was a lot of cutting. So I didn't go to high school.
What
much.
Kind of stuff were you up to? What were you rather doing?
Smoking weed, drinking. That was it. I would rather not be doing work. I was into boys. You know, I wanted to be into boys. And it was a very at high school I had a very dualistic experience, right? So I had my church life and my church family, and I had my school friends and my school life, and none of the two should meet. Like, even my friends from church wouldn't like hang out with me in high school because I had my little, you know, popular group of friends, and they didn't really fit in that group of friends.
Did they all still go to the same high school? Y'all went, but just different social spheres.
Yeah, it was interesting.
How did you balance these two worlds?
Well, you know, it just happened effortlessly. I don't think it was ever, you know, it never came up, you know, in my social group at church. You know, they were ever like, why don't you play with us at school? Never. And, you know, I think that they just, I think that they were probably intimidated by the girls I was hanging out with anyhow, so they were just like, I'm probably not going to be with those girls. And they were cool with us being, I think that I have the ability of always to make people feel comfortable around me. And so no matter when I spent time with people, they were happy in that time, right? Mm-hmm. So it wasn't like, they felt neglected by me in school because I spoke to them, of course. It wasn't like I was just like, I'm not speaking to you in school. It wasn't a mean girl thing. Mm-hmm. It was just that we had different groups of friends. And a lot of that, too, was because if you think about it, we were all, it might have been different elementary schools anyhow, so we already had different bodies of friends in school than we did outside of school, mm-hmm. right? So it just followed through to high school where we were all together, you know what I mean, in this one space. So, yeah, so I realized that I had this sort of dual life, and it went on years in my 20s because I realized that I separated everything in my life because I sort of grew up like that. That continued on into my adulthood, and keeping my friend group separate, right? And that, you know, if I work people, work friends were not the same thing as home friends. Home friends were not the same as religious, you know, or spiritual friends. And so, and I wasn't really keen on mixing that till I think about 10 years ago when I started to really evaluate that for myself and think about and start moving in a way that my work was very much about my life, right? And the things that I love, a life. And so now I'm able to like, do work, the work that I do is it's very much informed by my lifestyle. So, you know, I work in environmental issues because the environment is everything about my spirituality. And so it makes sense for me to do this work. And so it makes sense that my friends who do this work as well will have the same interests as me in the social world. Mm-hmm. So now I have friends who I work with, right? And allowing myself to have that, it was a big deal for me. Mm-hmm. It was challenging for me to integrate that.
In high school, when you had these two different, when those social spheres first evolved, what was it that each sphere was giving you? What was it you were having met? What needs were being met by
those different? Well, and I think that, you know, being in the growing up in the church, but also having this really this sense that there's so much more than just that. Even at a young age, right? Like, you know, I really thought that there was more to life than just this.
What do you mean by more than?
Well, because the religious institutions are sort of all-encompassing, right? So everything you get, you're supposed to get. Everything you need, you're supposed to get from the church. And so, and that I was, you know, and that wasn't true for me. And I knew that wasn't true for me. So I knew that I had to get those other things from outside of this, you know, the spiritual sanctuary, right? Mm. Of religious context and dogma. And I think that is I've started feeling like the like something is missing very much in junior high school with regards to my religion and what I needed for my wholeness as a being, right? Mm-hmm. So I dabbled. I would imagine that's what I at the time would call it, right? You know, dabbled in some secular some secular activities. My parents were actually really cool. My mom was very much, because she didn't grow up in a church. She actually decided that she was going to go to church at some point, and she and her sister started going on her own to, like, you know, the church that where she met my father, which is evangelical, a lot different from the Baptist church that her mom went to, you know, where you just go to church on Sunday.
So it's your dad's like an evangelical pastor?
Yeah. He's Pentecostal.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's a very different, you know, experience, right, in the evangelical tradition than it is in, like, a Baptist tradition. And way more is expected of you than in the Baptist world. So she, you know, chose that life of her own, but she always felt like my mother always felt like those folks who grew up in the church in a very strict way, always when they were left, like after they left those homes, their homes or whatever, they would wild out. That's her, you know, mm-hmm. They would just wild out because they had been so so repressed for so long that when they left out of that, you know, they were able to. And so she was really clear with my father, who grew up in church all his life, that we would be able to have some secular experiences so that we wouldn't feel like, you know, we had been isolated as young people. And so we were, you know, so I was allowed to, right, experience and experiment in all these different ways. Mm. And as the middle child, I was sort of, they were sort of like, you're the only one who wants to do these things or that does these things, and it's only you, and it's only you. But I was just like, okay, whatever. It's, you know, I was the most inquisitive of my sisters, so it just made sense that I would, you know, go looking and searching for other things. Mm. My dad, you know, I was always just a curious child, so, you know, I was expected for me to do things a little bit differently than, because that was my, you know, personality, mm-hmm. I guess. Yeah.
When your sister, how much older is your oldest sister?
So my sister, older than me, she's 2.5 years, and my sister younger than me is 1.5. So we're about two, we're all 2 grades apart, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So we say 2 years apart, but she's a little bit older than me.
So when you were in high school, and mm-hmm. she's about to finish high school, what was the expectation for the next step of your lives as young women?
Yeah, well, we were always going to college, all of us. So, you know, it was sort of like what you did after high school. It wasn't because my mom and dad went to school. My dad went to Lincoln, he did, but he left to get married to my mom. So, so he didn't finish school then. He did go back later on and finish his degree. And so it was just, you know, common sort of expectations for us to go. It was really cool when my sister went to school first, because then we were able to visit her at college.
Where did she end up going to school?
She went to Stockton State, which I went to do after her. She went to Stockton State until she transferred to Delaware State, because she was a ball player and she had to get to a title, whatever school. I don't really know the whole thing, but she went to go to a better basketball division school. but then she messed her knee up, so she just finished out. And my younger sister actually went to community college, so she stayed with my parents. She lived with my, at home until she was 30-something, until she got married. Mm-hmm. The traditional way, apparently. That's what they say. So,
is it?
Yeah, I know. That's what I keep saying. I was like, is that what it's called? I didn't know. I missed that class.
I'm glad I missed it.
I was cutting. So yeah, I just left as soon as I was finished. You know, when I went to college, I never went back. So not until I actually was pregnant, I went home for a little while I was pregnant to stay with my parents. And but I was never coming back home. I
think so you knew you wanted to leave.
Yeah, definitely.
Where did you go?
Anywhere. So I went to school at Stockton, which is near Atlantic City, down there in Atlantic City for the first 2 years. I went to a lot of different colleges. Actually, I had a fun time. I went to the University of Maryland.
Did you go to Stockton in part because your sister was there?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, it's what we knew. We didn't know a lot about college, how to get into schools and stuff like that. We had already forged relationships there, that kind of thing. And also, I didn't have the best grades, so it was like, okay, go to a state school, get your grades up so you can go somewhere else, which is why I transferred 2 years later to the University of Maryland, which is a huge school, and it was like, well, and that didn't go well. So all my friends were at Howard. And so I would just, like, stay at Howard all the time. And the school, the big, giant 40,000 people on campus thing was way more than I bargained for. And then my parents were like, okay. So I didn't do so well there. And my parents were like, okay, so come on home. Mm-hmm. And then I went to Glassboro. So I ended up going to, which is now Rowan University. That was the year I was graduating was the year they were switching over to Rowan, actually. And so, so I did a lot of school and stuff. And in college was fun. I just had a bunch of fun, which I really am under the impression, like, I really fully feel that college is about personal experience, not really about what you're learning in the classroom. So it's who you meet during school, it's who, you know, the parents who help you get jobs when you get out, it's the relationships you have with your professors, or the recommendations that you get that you need and when you get a job and move forward. So, you know, it's not really about the schooling, because you're not really learning things that you can apply later on in life. In college, it's an experience as an adult with no responsibilities. So it's the most fun you'll have as an adult. And I took advantage of that to the fullest advantage. I drove up and down the coast, went to all the HBCs I could, you know, HBCUs I could, every historical black college I could go to, a party that I did. I met lots of people and did amazing things.
Tell me about the experiences of the HBCUs.
Yeah. Oh wow.
I've heard Ta-Nehisi Coates talk about Howard as the Mecca.
Yeah.
And I love that imagery.
Yeah.
Talk to me about that.
I love reading that. I was like, yes, it really was. It was like, you know, this place where all these beautiful black people were, and they're all, you know, smart and thinking about things and going places. And it was nestled in this huge chocolate city that, you know, was black people everywhere. So it was awesome for me, you know, to go there all the time. My best friend was there, so I was there all the time. I have friends still from Howard who think I went to school there, because that's how much I was there. Like, wait a minute, you didn't go to Howard? I'm like, yeah, no. I was just there all the time. I stayed out there a summer, you know. It was good times. But, yeah, it was definitely, having this safe space, right? This historically black college as a safe space for black folks to come together and be free, right? And practice what it is to be free is a big deal, right? Having the resources and the support, maybe through faculty or whomever, to behind your ideas and your dreams. And, you know, at the time when my best friend was in school, you know, Puffy was in school there, so they were, you know, they were just entertainers, you know, who now are these big people, you know. I met one of my cousins there, and he's eventually formed Digital Planet. So, you know, we had, you know, all these people at the time who were thinking in these really forward ways about how to move, you know, forward in entertainment, rather, in all these different ways. Ras Baraka himself, his son, his father, was there at the time. So, you know, it was the 90s, and it was, you know, the era of De La Soul and the Native Tongues. And so we were all, you know, thinking about, you know, metaphysically thinking about things and building on ways as we party, you know, into the daylight. So it was great fun, you know, and a lot of learning and a lot of political learning, right, and understanding our position, our situation, and watching people grow as we move forward.
Can you tell me a little bit about that? So you've talked about this childhood experience that was really diverse and not a real strong sense of discrimination or oppression in that childhood space that was this safe space. And then funneling into a junior high, more and more perspectives and communities coming together. eventually emerging as a person who has a real strong sense of self mm-hmm. and the roles of justice in the community that you're a part of. Tell me about that transition of that, those realizations. When did that sort of, when did those realizations come to you?
Yeah, I think that when I look at, when I think about the progression of the human development, right, I think that during you know, when we get to our later teen years is when a lot of us start dissecting institutional racism, right? So, you know, you were brought up, and so for me, you know, being brought up in this radical Black tradition, you know, I had heard and understood to some degree, right, what that was, but then, you know, when you go to college, you get that sort of book learning and really digging into, you know, because I took like every single African-American history class I could take, every single one, in all the schools that I went to, and so, you know, understanding it in an institutional way is just like really hard, right? And it really hits hard that, damn, this shit is going on, and it's going on like this. And you know, you had heard the experiences talked about, you know, but when you understand it to be this systematic thing, it just is a whole lot deeper. And so the anger, I think, that comes with a lot of young people at that age, because I think that's when a lot of us figure out the institutional barriers that are put or that are in play that affect our lives during that period of time, you know, between 18 and 21. Mm. And so, because I've watched it, you know, in other people as life is going on, just, like, that is just a very, you know, real period of development for understanding those things, and then people are angry in all these different ways, you know, because of the truth of our existence, mm-hmm. right, in this society. And so, yeah, it was, you know, definitely was, you know, and why, like, I would gravitate, right, to this more radical Black spaces of people instead of like maybe more the multicultural thing. So when I first went to Stockton, I had a friend note to me, and she was in my gospel choir, and she said, Trina, you just have like such an, like, I just see you have so many friends, so many different, she's such a diverse body of friends. Like every time I come through this hall, I see you with a different group of people, and none of them are the same. And you just like, you know, so I don't have a problem, you know what I mean, intermixing with other folk. I never, you know, saw that as an issue. But what, you know, but understanding my situation, right, means that, you know, sometimes I move myself into spaces of comfort because it's necessary, right, mm-hmm. For me to have security, for me to stay balanced, for me to get validation, right, for my experience in certain ways. So those Black spaces were important and necessary for me. My parents didn't want me to go to Black college, right? Mm-hmm. So I wasn't able. Which, interesting enough, you know, it's like the Black schools get a bad rep, which is so not the experience that it's, you know, it's sort of like the one story thing, you know, and that, you know, this dominant narrative says that, you know, Black schools, they party too much, you know, that you won't get anything done. Oh, it's not like the real world because you have to interact, you know, we're integrated now, you know. But the reality is all of my friends that went to HBCUs are all hella successful right now because of having that grounding, right, amongst, in that safe space to be able to believe in themselves and the people around them who look like them and encourage them to do things in a way, in a certain way. So my daughter is at an HBCU because of that, and because I just watch, you know, all of my friends that went to Howard, all of my friends that went to Hampton, all of my friends, they are all successful today, mm-hmm. right? And those of us who went to, you know, who struggled along in these in white, majority white schools, you know, and had these really racial experiences, and that caused us to challenge our identity, we're still able processing those things after the fact. So I feel like, you know, that during that time of period of growth for, you know, of development, personal development, that those safe spaces are really necessary because of what you're unpacking during that time, right? Mm-hmm. And so when you don't have that, it's a really different experience of growth growing up, and then you'll be struggling after to find that a little bit before you can move on, you know, depending on what kind of support you have in place. Mm-hmm. So I think that was, you know, that was really good for me to have those, you know, to search out in those spaces and have those spaces of development for myself and mm-hmm. be able to talk to people about, you know, openly about certain things. So, yeah.
When did you, so having these spaces of self-fulfillment, but also a fire, mm-hmm. What did you do with the fire?
Mm-hmm. Party. I danced everything away, you know, mm-hmm. not everything away, but I think it's, you know, very cathartic for me. And in the sense that I understood that, you know, I'm hugely a dancer. So, like, that was part of what I did as my release, right? Mm-hmm. And I did a lot of activism. So, you know, I was very much, you know, and I would say am I a couch activist now? People talk about it the way people talk about it, like not as much as it wasn't as active as I thought I was at the time. You know, at the time you feel like you're doing all kinds of things as you're sitting around talking about these, you know, doing these things and making these moves with people that you never really moves that you never really made and you just talked about. So, you know, I felt like activism at the time, very much not active, but verbal activism, I would imagine it was. So, you know, I don't think that, yeah, just dancing would be my relief at the time. I don't think that there was other release than that. I wish there was, but no. Right after school, though, I think that the radicalness that was a part of my life for a long time wasn't completely fulfilling. And that's when my relationship with nature began.
Well, tell me more.
Yeah. So about two or three years after school, after college.
Where did you go after? So after what became
Maryland,
Rowan?
And Glassboro. Right, no, Rowan.
And then that was it. The next step,
so I didn't graduate from Rowan, but I walked. Mm-hmm. I was like, I had three more classes to take, which I never took, and then ended up graduating years later. So I went back to school in my 30s to finish my degree. But I was like so much done with school, my parents were like, oh, we're not paying for not one more class. And I was like, okay, well, I'm done anyhow. So...
where did life take you from then?
So then I'm back to Philadelphia. You know, we mostly go to the places, the city that's closest to our childhood, right? So I live with my cousins here in Philadelphia. And
where in Philly?
In Mount Airy. Mm-hmm. Mount Airy, yeah. Uptown, that's what they call it now. Mm-hmm. And my cousins had a house, and they're my age, but their mother, who's also my cousin, they're my second cousin, she had passed away, so she left them the house, so they had a house. And we all sort of lived there at some point, right? All of the cousins lived there at some point. And I stayed with my cousins there for a couple of years before I got my own place. And I was here in Philadelphia, you know, and I'd say all the time, the party kid scene, you know what I mean? We just went to clubs and stuff like that, sat around with my homies and talked about, you know, black righteousness and, you know, different, we studied, you know, Dr. Malachi York and different black leaders at the time who were present, you know, the Nations of Gods and Earth. Metaphysical knowledge and different, and that was really futuristic, right? In this thinking of, you know, of ourselves and who are our ancestors and who are we connected to and this is our, you know, our third time being here and, you know, how many times we've been on this planet and, you know, how we've grown in that person and who we were in a different life. And sort of that, and that we came from this planet here and this star here and that star gave us this, you know, and I got my daughter's name from the Enuma Elish, which is like the oldest text ever found in the world. Mm. It comes from Babylonia, in Syria. So, you know, so we were studying, you know, we were studying all kinds of things.
What's your daughter's name?
Enlil. Mm. Yeah. So she comes from the story of Enki and Enlil, which is a Sumerian Babylonian text. Story of creation story, actually, which is called the Enuma Elish. And that was found in like the 1920s, so that was like this big, you know, deal that they had found this text that was like the oldest text ever found, and it had this creation story, and the creation story is very much and very similar to a lot of the other creation stories that we have. And so we had a lot of black scholars who had came out through the 70s and the 60s who were unpacking, you know, a lot of this African history for us. And so we're reading about, you know, all these things that, you know, that went against what we were taught that Africans did and Africans knew, right, and during that time. And so, you know, and that went along with, so the schooling, I think the education that I learned in high school and college through reading, college, not high school, couldn't do a lot of learning in high school, was the textbook, like, you know, the American, the African-American experience, right? And so on our own, we sort of experienced and explored the African experience, right? And then also the African alien experience, right? And thinking about ourselves as more than just these human beings, right? But like in cosmic beings, right? And what is our place in the cosmic, you know, thing, in the cosmic way of life? And so, yeah, we were definitely, you know, kids that were thinking about, you know, ourselves as stars and understanding ourselves to be, you know, star people. And that, you know, our existence was not just this thing that we know as life right here, right? And this everyday life, and that there was something way more to life than just our experiences with each other every day. And so when I think about my, so then that sort of informed and pushed me to explore more around cosmology and cosmologies and what sort of and who we are as universal beings, right? And how we came to this earth and what are we supposed to be doing when we're here? So then the ultimate question of why are we here is like, what's guiding me next?
I love hearing this. How did that, this new sense of the cosmic connection, mm-hmm. how did that square with this evangelical yeah. upbringing? Right. Was that still a part of your life too, yeah. that social sphere?
No, so, right. So I had to, the
divide
conflict.
Is still there.
Yeah, that was the conflict that came. So, you know, when I was about 21, I guess, when I was 19, I knew that I didn't want to do religion anymore. But of course, you know, it's my foundation. So I had a very long battle with understanding how to walk away, right? But I did, and
how did that play out with your father?
It's still playing out, my friend. it's still playing out. So you know, I'm an adult. I'm not home, so there's not a whole lot they can do about that. You mm-hmm. know what I mean? It's just like, you know, so they just question me constantly about, you know, and they think, oh, she's in a backsliding state. You know, first I'm backsliding, then it's like, you know, actually this is my way of life. You know, that 15 years later, I'm like, and it's the way of my child's life. And then 30 years later, it's like, okay, so this is me. Can you please accept it? But it's, you know, so it's an ongoing battle, most definitely. Mm-hmm. and for me inside it, internally, it was an ongoing battle. There were things that I saw as a child that were hard to dismiss. So, you know, I've seen people possess the demons. I've seen people who've had demons taken out of them or whatever they call it, exercise, mm-hmm. right? I think for me, that was those were the hardest things for me to tackle. So I wanted to know, there were certain things that I just was like, okay, so how do we explain this, right? Like, I saw this happen, and so what is the explanation of that? And that guided my learning experience, right, and trying to understand energy, right, and how energy coalesces in this world and how it manifests and how we manipulate it and how it can be manipulated. With just thing we're talking about energy, but this is like real, like really just thinking about that in my 20s, in my early 20s, about energy, and then my learning and understanding of energy helped me to process what I saw in a way that made sense, I think, you know, scientifically, and, you know, and not just so, you know, not in a mystery way, right? Not in this mysterious, like, you know, oh my God, there's these demons and there's these, you know what I mean? Just understanding things as energy helped me a lot to understand, you know, what I had experienced growing up. And then it put a lot of language to other experiences, too, that I had growing up. I mean, my understanding of energy and how energy works and how waves work and how all of that really explained away a lot of the things that I found were, that I thought or saw as mysterious when I was growing up. Mm.
Mm-hmm. You talked about this time being in Mount Airy, moving back to Philly, mm-hmm. being there as also a time of your sort of environmental awakening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Talk to me about how that mm-hmm. cosmology and the sense of energy moving through the world in this time in your life was, and that place maybe
right.
even. I mean, you're close to the Wissahickon. Mm-hmm. It's such a tree-rich area.
Yeah,
tell me about this kind of environmental awakening in the midst of this spiritual awakening.
Mm-hmm. So as I was studying, so my studies, you know, were very metaphysical in nature. I guess after a while, stopped being as nourishing for me because they were also really patriarchal, right? They were men. They were texts that or philosophies that came from black males, but were very patriarchal. And so for me, even in the church, my whole thing was always sort of like, where are the women, right? So where am I in this story, you know? And so so inevitably, I say, Jesus introduced me to his mother. And so I found, I think one of my girlfriends gave me this book, The Great Cosmic Mother, right? And which is like the Bible for all of us earth worshipers. And that was my introduction into sort of this world of the goddess, right? And so that put a lot of grounding to the metaphysical stuff that I was dealing with, that I was researching and studying. And
what do you mean by grounding?
Right. So that's what I was gonna say. So I think that the context. So the reality of as above, so below is really, really evident and clear in so many ways. And so what I was reading, in The Cosmic Mother was very similar to what I had been reading in these other contexts, but it was very, very enriched with this feminine understanding of it in an earthly way, right? Whereas the other things that I was reading was very universal and male in a cosmic way, right? So I saw it as an extension of, right, like the below and you know, like these things here that are mirroring these things here, and that I actually resonate more with the earthly way of understanding these same concepts, right? than the cosmic way, because the cosmic way for me was felt really heady, felt not grounded in the earth, and I felt like, you know, this is where I exist, right? This is what I know. Then what that teaching should be able to be applied to my earthly experience, and so I found that in the text, in the expression of the goddess, right, in the religion of the goddess, and so that is sort of like that was how that happened for me. And looking for this place, because, you know, even the folks that I was building with were mostly men, right? And you know, so understanding the dynamics just within our, you know, our study circles and our study groups was like, okay, there has to be something other. And so when I started reading more things about the goddess and or the religion of the goddess and sort of understanding the earth structures, right, and how earth energies are manifested, it spoke so much to me that I knew that it was where I was supposed to be going. So it was just like, okay, this is the path that you should be on. And that separated me, actually, for a while from my black sort of radical spaces, right? Because it wasn't, no longer was I studying things that black folks were studying so much. So I didn't know at the time any black women who were really into that. Just a few of us, actually. I have a few friends there from California, of course. You know, those West Coast people who are always got their heads in the cloud. So it was a solitary journey. I had one good friend of mine, and she was a white woman. And she and I, like, you know, raised our kids together pretty much in the woods. And they bought some land, like, maybe 2 years after that. She and her husband, who was her boyfriend at the time, bought some land upstate New York, and this was 21 years ago, and we started camping, you know what I mean, and going to festivals, music festivals, and just like having these experiences in the woods. I had my daughter first, her children are younger than mine. But
tell me about becoming a mother. Was this around the same time?
That was 26, so now I'm at like age 26, and like 2 years into my, you know, sort of transition into my goddess. Mm-hmm. My environmental sort of goddess earth worship and studies. And so that was 26 when I had my daughter, or when I got pregnant, and 27 when I had her. And she was amazing, of course.
Yeah.
And during the process of being, you know, of carrying her and birthing her, I was like, oh, the black woman is God. So I knew, almost like, now I know that women are God. Like, why and how did anyone say anything different from this? I will never believe that. How they got to that must be some mind-compelling, you know, spell on men that says that, because anyone that can understand this process will understand that this is truly an act of miracle,
of creation.
Right? Of creation, and wow, like... So yeah, that being, you know, being pregnant, growing something inside you, like just the whole thing is just, you know, mind blowing to me, how amazing it is and how blessed I was to be able to carry a person, right?
Yeah.
And to fruition, and to, yeah, the creation thing is real.
Did you become a mother while living in Mount Airy?
I was in North Philly. By this time I was in Northern Liberties before it was like the...
Before it all got gentrified,
and all
the breweries came
in the beginning of gentrification. Yeah, so I was there at that time. So I was in and out of North Philly by that time. I was only with my cousins for that first 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, so then motherhood happened, and the you know, the experience that I was having religiously, spiritually, right, not religiously, spiritually, was very much embedded in just earth worship. And we had, and I think that also what I was studying with my within my black circles was very much about earth, you know, naturalness, right? So it's, you know, it's a very black natural, you know, it's the natural movement, right? So we were all about, you know, doing black natural things. And so, you know, so I thought, you know, part of that was, you know, what's nature, actual nature, not just natural hair, natural, you know, looking clothes, but like nature. And I'd be like, let's go to the, you know, and they'd be like, yeah, no, not really trying to go to the woods. I'm just saying we want to live a natural existence. So we had all these talks and these conversations about, you know, living in the woods and on our own and you know.
Had you ever done that before? I mean you grew up in the suburbs and we had like yards, but woods
never,
and stuff?
Never. Well, we had woods when I was growing up, like little pockets of woods that we would explore into. Absolutely. You know, it was all about exploring in these little natural, in the creek. We catch tadpoles and shit, but never... ever. Like, my parents, when I first took my daughter camping, was like, you're going where? What is going on now?
Where would you go?
Up to my girl, my friend's land.
Oh, so when they bought that place in New York.
Yeah, we just started
that
camping
was the
there.
Too.
Yep, every year. So we camped every year, sometimes two or three times a summer, you know what I mean? And there, outside of there, we go to festivals, music festivals where you camp out, mm-hmm. you know, for the weekend or whatever. And so, yeah, that was an interesting, you know, turn. And a lot of my friends weren't into it. So that's sort of the separation, was really not necessarily about the change in what I was studying, but more so about the fact that I wanted to be in these spaces. And they were like, yeah, but I'm not ready for that yet. You know what I mean? So, you know, black folks don't camp and that kind of thing, you know, which is so untrue. Now I'm very blessed to have this huge, enormously beautiful group of black folks around me who are all about natural spaces and all about camping and all. So that, you know, just had to happen. It had to be, you know, it's timing, right? Mm-hmm. At the time, the folks that I was hanging out with weren't down with that. So, you know, so we separated because of that, and because of other things, I'm sure. We got old. I got pregnant. So once I had my child, all of my priorities changed, right? Mm-hmm. So it didn't make, you know, my priority wasn't hanging out at the club, sitting around my homies and chit-chatting and talking about the, you know, philosophizing about the future. I was like, okay, I have to take care of this, you know, this little being who's counting on me for, you know, for daily life. And so, yeah, so my priorities shifted.
How? Tell me about how.
As a mother? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, you know, it was about how do I put food on the table, right? How do I make sure that she has a space that is comfortable and is safe, right? So, you know, my living, you know, where we lived was really important. Making sure that I was working consistently was really important. Making sure that she had, like, the most experiences that she could possibly have to fill her head with all things imaginable was really important to me. So she was everything, actually, to me for them. You know, I didn't have space in my head for anything else. And I made that commitment because I was just so in awe of who she was. Mm-hmm. And I was like, yes, nothing else matters but her. So that's just how that went for a long time.
Yeah.
She was connected to my hip.
Tell me about how you merged the spiritual awakening, the new kind of social connections you're starting to make, but also motherhood with your work life.
Yeah.
I mean, when did those things start to become more synthesized?
Well, work, actually, so in my late 20s, after I had my child, so I've been maybe 2 years into, you know, she was about two and her toddler years, I did a real, you know, a real search, so soul searching of, like, sort of what makes me happy, what do I want to do in life? Really, because I needed to, you know, because I didn't have a career path, right? I went to school for communications. It's like, what is that? What do you do with that? So, and I knew I didn't really want to do communications. I didn't want to do PR, public relations, which is what I ended up sort of trying to focus on. But that was just, you know, too mirrored in this capitalist marketed thing that I was totally against. You know, I'm an anti-capitalist. So, and have been for a long time. So, you know, I was like, okay, what can I do? You know, I don't want to work. And because I did some temping, and so in the temping I was able to experience corporate America in these different ways, you know, just to see if this is what, you know, does that make sense for me? It very much could have been a marketing, whatever, because I have the passion, right, to do that thing, but not really, but feeling very uncomfortable with the field, right, and understanding that that's not, you know, that is not a part of who I am. Yeah. Like, I can't be.
Just, those aren't the interests you want to work toward.
Not at all, mm-hmm. Right. So I did a whole long soul search and looked back at my path and realized that actually I was most happiest when I'm in service to others. And so that was when I was about 28. And so then I realized, then I knew that, okay, so I'm going to stay in nonprofit work because this way I'll always be in service to others. So I just started, and I actually started off, it wasn't nonprofit work specifically, but I was doing, I was working with children with disabilities. So that is what, and that allowed me to work in the school so that I had the same work hours as my child. So that's what things that are important to me, that I'm home with my kid. She's not a latchkey kid. She's not going to after school programs all day long, all evening long, that she's in school for regular school time, and then we're home together. And so I didn't take a lot of other jobs or extra jobs, like some people thought, you know, I should have ever, whatever, because it's most important that she be with me, right? That I'm influencing my child's decisions and my child's development. And so, you know, I didn't make a lot of money at all. And in the summer times I was off, right? Which means I had no money in the summertime, but I was out camping, so I didn't care. But somehow we were blessed and favored, and we still, you know, kept the house over our head. And eventually we moved upstate New York because I wanted to have my child grow up in the woods. Yeah, I wanted her to run freely and be free and feel free and not be bogged down by the things that young people in cities, you know, feel like they have to be hard and the hard life of the city. I didn't want my child growing up like that. I knew I wasn't raised in the city. I didn't want her to be raised in the city. I was not taking her to the suburbs. So, and my, you know, everything that we were learning and living in was about the environment. So I wanted her to be growing, to grow up with this real visceral relationship, right, to Gaia. So, like, you know, like, let me just take her up there. So we moved up north.
Where'd you go up north?
We went up not too far from where the land was, right? So we had this whole plan. It was like a bunch of us and our eclectic group of people. And we were like, yes, we're going to do an exodus to the land. And we're going to live on the land and eat and feed each other. And and so three families moved up. And we all moved to different counties. And we never saw each other again except for the same time that we would meet every year before that. So it's so funny. And even the people who had the land never moved up there. It was just like, we were moving to your land and you're not moving up here. And they were like, we're not ready yet. So we had amazing experiences on the land for so long, and we moved up to Oneonta, so that's right outside of where the land is that we would camp out all the time.
Oneonta?
Yeah, Oneonta. When we first moved, we moved to right where the camp, where the land was, which was outside of Oneonta, which is this little tiny town, which had like a K-12 school, and that was like the worst racial experience ever. That was just the worst racial experience. It was just too much. I was like, okay, this is too much. Too much in the country. Let's just go ahead and camp.
It was all white rural folks.
Who act like they never saw black folks in their lives. Like, they wouldn't play with my kids at school. Like, little kids would tell her, like, we don't play with brown people. And she would come home with these stories, and I would be, like, bawling. Listen, she was so strong. She was in second grade, and she would come home, like, with her fist in the air, like, I am black and beautiful. I don't even know. I was, like, I didn't even realize I had embedded all that in her. But she was so strong through all that. And I was, like, distraught, trying to hold myself together, like, tell me more. And then I was there every day, you know, like, what the hell? What the hell's going on? Because I'm hugely an advocate for my child. Mm-hmm. And so, and you know, especially because I worked in school, so I know how that works. If you're not there, they don't care about your kid, mm-hmm. especially if they're a child of color. And so, so I've always been a huge advocate and a proponent that parents have to be advocates and be on, you know, at your school all the time for them to know that you care. Mm-hmm. If not, they treat your kid mediocre at best. And so the, you know, the teacher was sort of like, oh, I don't see a problem. I was like, okay, I got it. She got to go. So she's out of here within a month, and she went to the Montessori school, which is a better experience, of course, but very challenging for the teachers because my kid is pretty, you know, she's a fire sign too, and very opinionated. And they had this, you know, rule where kids can do whatever they want to, right? And if they didn't want to go to other things, they didn't have to, as long as they can explain themselves. So she explained herself out of everything and stayed in one corner the whole time and play in the play area. And they were like, so we think that you need to, and I was like, but you told her that she could do that. So unless you can make her do the thing. And they were like, we can't. I was like, well, then that's what you get. Of course, she's an amazing student, like literally has been an A student all her life. So that was not the issue. The issue is that they couldn't make her do anything because she could explain her way out of everything. This is why I want to be here. And it made sense, you know? It was like, she said to the guy in second grade when they took this field trip to this church, and the preacher was saying how, you know, you need schools. Schools are the thing, because if we didn't have schools, people wouldn't learn. And she's like, well, then how did the first person ever learn? They were like, whose kid is this? So she's like, that's not true. I know that's not true. I learn all the time at home, you know? So she's pretty, she's just always pretty amazing. And it was a really, you know, for me, it was really challenging. So we left and moved closer to the city where we had friends at anyhow.
Which city?
In Oneonta. Mm. City, Oneonta. Mm. Not really city, but town, mm. which was the college town. So that, you know, that was my upstate New York. I stayed in college towns because at least there's some kind of diversity, right? Mm. And Oneonta, there's very, very little diversity. But and what it was probably in the college. It was from the college, not necessarily in the town. But because there wasn't a lot of even like a small trickle of black folks, there wasn't a lot of visible racism, right? So I didn't experience a lot of any other. Like we had the most amazing 5 years in Oneonta. We just, you know, played music, and you know, had friends had land, and we stayed on the land, and we swam in rivers and waterfalls, and she just had, you know, amazing experiences. We just had so much fun there.
When you say stay in the land, what does that mean?
Camping out on people's land, people who have acres of land, and we just sit out and camp out for days and eat together and play music together and, you know, take care of each other and love each other. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's fun.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, it's good times. We all talk back. We want to go back to Wildwood. My friend's land was called Wildwood. He had festivals there. It was good. They were all musicians, right, and artists. All of my friends, it seemed that later on someone had asked me, and I was like, I have really good friends who are white. And they were like, well, they must be all radical. And I was like, oh, you know, you're right. So they're all artists and radical in some way, right? In some way, they're definitely anti-establishment, right? So they weren't like your average white folk, you know what I mean? There were people who were really against like living in a certain way, in a box, right? Like, we're not gonna live in a box. So, you know, my friends were carpenters and stonemasons and, you know, guitar players and singers, and it was good, you know, for a long time. But there was no school, like I couldn't make enough money in that town. It was just too small. Mm-hmm. There was no real industries there. Working in a nonprofit was cool, but not really fulfilling. And she was getting older, and she needed to be around more children who looked like her. So I thought that Ithaca was the next best place because, hey, there's brown folks in Ithaca, and they have a long-standing history of black folks there, and black and brown folks there. And so we moved to Ithaca from Oneonta, and that was like a really change, a complete change, because Ithaca is hella political. So we're in Oneonta, I didn't have any experience with the political, right? It was just about feeding my spirituality, feeding, and we had, you know, drum circles and women's sort of spaces and, you know, all these eclectic sort of, you know, cool, out-of-the-way things. And then all of a sudden it was like, pow, and I was like slapped into the, like, this is what's happening between white people and black people and Puerto Ricans, and everyone has an opinion. Everyone has bumper stickers. Never been to any place where the whole fucking place has an opinion, like, and you have to listen to a t-shirt say something, bumper stickers. It's like crazy. I couldn't go to the grocery store without people engaging me about, you know, issues. I was like, seriously, I just don't buy chips. So it was crazy, and very, very much an educational experience for me politically.
How so?
So it was where I needed to go when I had moved upstate New York. I had this I had convinced myself that multiculturalism was the way forward, right? And that I wanted my daughter to grow up in this experience of having all these different, you know, people around her from different walks of life, right? I just wanted her to have this diverse experience, you know, that would make her more of a full being to know and understand other people's plights, along with her own. And, you know, in searching for that upstate New York, is like, I was in a few different groups where we talked and studied, you know, we tried to be, you know, to create intentional communities, because, you know, I was always still on my path to live in the woods, right? Mm-hmm. Like, let's create intentional communities. And we wanted to have these diverse bodies of intention, but the diverse was like me and my kid. I was like, we can't be what is diverse in this group. Like, it can't be the two of us and all white folks for the rest of my life. Like, that doesn't feed me at all. And so once I realized that, I stopped doing the intentional community thing, and until, you know, and I said to ancestors, like, until that comes to me, you know what I mean? I know that this is what I want to do eventually, but until that comes to me, I'll leave that alone. You know, I'm not going to be searching for these groups that are, you know, living in the land on the, you know, in a way that's really cool. And so, we Ithaca was like, you have to, I had to participate. And I worked for a historically black community center, which I wanted to work for when I first moved there, because I read about it, and it has this, you know, historically amazing story of, you know, when it was created by these black folks who lived in the South Side, and they're like, you know, folks who were planted there from the on the Underground Railroad, and it's just like such an amazing story. Yeah. And then I got there, and they weren't really doing anything, and I was like, what's happening at the community center? And I was like, I want to work there, but I had this other job, the job that paid me a lot of money at the time for what I'd been making at the time, and was more, you know, and was more stable, of course.
What was that job?
I was working for people with disabilities, getting them jobs. Mm. And I worked there for a year, and it was so boring and so it didn't feed me at all. Like, I would fall asleep at my desk all the time. I was like, I can't believe I'm getting paid to do this. This sucks. Like, I don't want to just take money, you know, for, and even though the work was worthy, it wasn't enough of it. Mm. And it wasn't, you know, so I didn't feel fulfilled doing that. And it was boring the hell out of me. So I took a huge pay cut to take this job at the community center. But it was what I wanted to do. I wanted to work in that black community. I wanted to, you know, to change things. And so I did. And it was awesome.
What did you do?
Well, I was a program manager there, and we did a lot of stuff. So I was only in Ithaca for 3 years, but I feel like, you know, we did so much work. We started the Ithaca.
When was this, like, years-wise?
This was in 2000, I'm sorry. This was in 2009.
Okay.
2009, I was there from 2009 to 2012, okay, when I moved back here. And we started the Youth Farm Project when I was there, so that's when I got into food activism.
I was saying, yeah, when did the farm, you talk about the land,
yeah,
and
right,
and
so I was on the land forever. I was experiencing the land and creating a relationship with the land, and you know, very personal, very intimate relationships with the land. While I was in Oneonta, you know, that just allowed me to open up this whole thing that I had, you know, put my theory into practice, right? Mm-hmm. So I've been studying all these things for a very long time, and then I was able to do a lot of practicing spiritually on the land and with the land, right? And so Ithaca was like, and you know, even though I had like waterfalls down the street from my house, which is fucking awesome,
yeah,
I was barely able to like participate in that too much because I was so politically involved. Mm-hmm. And that's because of seeing the situation, right? So I can't really, you know, just a part of who I am, when I, as I told you earlier, when I see injustice, it's like, what? Well, this is not going down like that. So immediately I just jumped into what the community needed. You know, I just talked to people all the time. I talked to young people, I talked to elders, I talked to old people. Like, what do people need? What has happened before? What was the story before I got here? You know, what's the situation with the board? You know, so there's a lot of politics involved there. So I had to find all the answers, or not answers, get all this information so I can try to figure out, you know, what to do. And so lots of different work was accumulated during that period of time. We started the Black Community Leader of Color, the Community Leaders of Color, during that time that got started. We started the Youth Farm Project. There was a we started the Congo Square Market at the community center where I work at, which is an open air market for people of color to start entrepreneurial ideals. Mm. And we started a fresh fruit and vegetable snack program where we were able to provide a fruit and vegetable snack to two different schools that had the majority of students of color, like had the most students, not majorities, never majority of students of color, that had the majority, that had the most students of color and or the poorest schools, I guess, in the community, and were able to like introduce them to all these really good foods and stuff like that. And that's still going on. All these programs are still going on, which is really awesome to know that, you know, because that's always the worry when you leave a place. It's like, oh my God, will everything stop with me? Which is so funny that I even had that idea, but I'm so thankful now to know that, okay, you're tripping. And, you know, that's what planting seeds is about.
You build the foundation
about,
and
right?
It grows, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And so those programs are still going on, and it's great. And then, so Ithaca is like this microcosm of a city, right? Mm-hmm. It's considered a city, so it's, you know, designated as a city, so it moves in the same way that a big city would move. But because it's very small, you get to see a bird's eye view, mm-hmm, of what happens. And so that bird's eye view is really really bad and mean, and it feels bad to know that this is how things play out, mm-hmm, right? When you can see them actually here in Philadelphia, huge municipalities and all kind, and we're the county seat, and the, you know, there's all these different things happening that keeps us from actually seeing the mechanisms that create the divides and that create poverty and that create. But in Ithaca, you can see it really, really clearly. You can see why, you know, these folks aren't getting funding this way. Why? And that for me was like the hugest lesson while I was there. The political situation and understanding how things trickle down,
yeah,
and who's pulling strings was really. Yeah, because I was able to be in those spaces, like, you know, the mayor, you know, the superintendent of schools, you know, these folks, you know, you see them at the stores, you have conversations with them, and you see how the politics work, and it's ugly, right? Mm-hmm. And so I left because it was just too much on my child, actually. So she was getting to the age where her identity, you know, was being challenged in the town where Black folks are always the minority. In a town where the brown folks and Black folks who did live there have so many social agencies that they don't really understand the impacts, you know, of race in a way that, you know, that is informed, right? So there's no real political education, mm-hmm, of the people there. There's, you know, certain people that, you know, and then there's this huge contingency of brown and Black folks who are trying to keep the status quo, right? Mm-hmm. So I was way too radical for that city ever. I was always way too radical.
Philly needed you.
Right. I was way too radical for Ithaca. They were just like, you know, they got, you know, the colleges there, so we had the Black elite that you had to deal with, mm-hmm, you know, and mm-hmm, so, and you have a huge group of like white hippies from the 60s who moved out there and started these social justice organizations to get, you know, so there's this codependency, mm-hmm, that's happening there that's just like so different from, you know, what I know, right?
So before we get, let's just maybe take a break here before we step into Philly and then thinking, uh-huh, about Philly's future.
Yes, we gotta do futures because what time is it?
Yeah.